Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, your weekly guide to education matters in Ireland and further afield, brought to you by me, Sean Delaney. Podcasts of previous programmes are available from seandelaney.com/podcasts. You can get in touch with me through Twitter at InsideEd or by email to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. On last week's programme, I brought you the first part of my interview with Jacinta Kitt. We spoke to mark the publication by the National Association of Principals and Deputy Principals of Jacinta's new book, Positive Behaviours, Relationships and Emotions, The Heart of Leadership in a School. Jacinta Kitt has for many years been working with schools to help them improve the workplace environment for entire school communities. One of the main themes of Jacinta's book is about the quality of relationships in a school. At the end of last week's programme, we had begun to talk about collegial relationships where teachers share their experiences and ideas with colleagues and develop their teaching through discussions with one another. Jacinta begins this next part of our conversation by advocating the approach of cooperative learning as one that she would like to see more widely implemented in schools.
One of the things that I think is so badly neglected still in schools is teaching in the cooperative learning manner. And I think that is just amazing for so many elements of the development of the child, not just academically, but socially, emotionally. And it's so good. It's the exact opposite to the highly competitive environment that really is so passé now if we are going to be doing a good job in schools. And yes, I think it's not as prevalent as it should be.
And how do you understand cooperative learning?
It is group work, but it's a methodology where the work is not completed within the group until everybody understands what's going on. So there's a teaching and learning within the group, and it's the group success that matters. The only people that might speak out against it are those who would have the children who are way ahead in class and say, oh, it'll hold them back. But it doesn't hold them back, because it's amazing. In the reinforcing of things with others, they're getting a greater insight into the specific task. Also the social skills, the sense of justice, the sense of fairness, the impact of the cooperative learning system on bullying in schools and all of that. Just unbelievable. But still, you know, children are set against each other. You know, they have the kind of competitive thing that's manifested in sometimes in the student of the week or the, you know, the gold stars or whatever. And, you know, I say that in some schools and they're tutting and saying, oh, look at what the hell are you going on about? You have to be able to give them a bit of, you know, reward. And of course, but reward is best given as something is done, rewarding the thing that has been achieved, instead of setting them against each other, creating effectively winners and losers. Why would you bother your head doing it? Why would you pick student of the week? And when there's a good possibility that you'll get it wrong in terms of effort, commitment, improvement and whatever. So you've created one person who gets it and the rest of them are all losers. But people don't see that. And I mean, I'm not saying throw baby out with bathwater. I'm saying we should be reflecting more on our ways of motivating children to work. So the collegial relationships, let's not forget the relationships, of course, between the adults and the children in the school. And I deal with those under the heading of democratic relationships, because I believe that the children, the students, are our partners, and that we as teachers are not superior to them. There is no hierarchy of importance in the classroom. We are, in fact, equal to them. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have authority and all of that. That's not taking away from the authority, but it's taking away from a teacher's ability to talk down to a child, perhaps. Those days are gone. You can't talk down to a child. And I have cited an incident where I met somebody on holidays with a little boy, and I happen to know where they live. So I asked him what school he went to, and she cited a school about, as we'll say in the country, about three parishes away. And I said, why did you pick that particular school when you had like two or three? We heard they don't give out to them there, she said. And I asked her just to elaborate, even though I didn't need to. And she said, we've heard they don't shout at them. And we heard that they're not fearful. We're going into it. They go in happy and they come out happy, you know. And I said in my book that, as I said to them, that's a very good reason to pick a school. So it's the notion that they are our partners, You know, and then it means that as a teacher, you don't take yourself too seriously and you don't overreact if a child says something, you know, that you can say, you know, you can bring silence. Very powerful job. You can bring silence to a classroom if you just say, sorry, what did you just say there? And they're all afraid. They're all waiting, you know. And I mean, we don't have the right to do that. You know, and part of it is if we take ourselves too seriously, if we think we are superior to the children. So democratic relationships between, and there's no danger of children losing the run of themselves in that type of relationship, because, you know, you can poke the polecat with behaviours of children, or you can manage the behaviours. And for years we poked the polecat.
What's poke the polecat mean?
Poke the polecat, make it worse, you know. Make them overreact. Turn a small misbehaviour into an international incident, you know. And then that child is upset and that child feels abused and, you know, discriminated against. And the whole thing escalates up. Probably more with the secondary school, you know, where they're into their own stride as regards personality and hormones and emotions and everything. And the whole thing is to try and diffuse. Diffuse is one of the best skills that you can have as a teacher, and so good for yourself. You know, if you escalate it up and they're fighting, sure, you're stressed to the nines yourself. But if you can say to yourself, how best can I handle this behaviour? So, and diffusing is the first one. I'm going to diffuse it. And a win-win outcome with students. Always think of it. Not, you know, I'm the boss and I'm going to get my way here and you're going to admit to being wrong, but to get in the win-win. So many teachers are brilliant at it. They're brilliant at it now. And they're learning so much more about that type of management of behaviour. But there's still some that lose the cool, you know, still some teachers lose the cool. And we all lose the cool from time to time. And I would always say, when you have a democratic relationship, if you do lose the cool, you apologise. You know, and even if you're not able to apologise there and then because you're too angry, you know, get a bit of space for yourself, change the subject or whatever, and do it when you're calmer and say, look, I shouted at you earlier and I said some things and I'm really sorry about that. And, you know, traditionally teachers might think that that would usurp their authority or it would undermine their, but you can't put a superlative on the respect that that gains for a teacher. To be able to apologise when you've done wrong. You can't be going around apologising all the time, of course. But if you have done wrong to a child, it's wonderful. And it's wonderful for that relationship. But it's also wonderful for the relationship with other children, because they're more at ease and they're more trusting, you know, and more relaxed, which is the way you have to be to learn, as you know. If you're uptight, you can't learn.
And that brings us to the third part of the title of the book, which is emotions.
Yeah.
What's their role in relationships amongst staff?
I suppose teaching is recognised as being one of the most emotional jobs of all. And it's really quite interesting. I think we should be talking about how difficult teaching is more often in society, because I don't think the job of teaching is recognised as being as difficult as it is. People are still focusing on what they call the half day and the half year holidays. They have no idea of the intensity that goes into that. It's not a half day, of course, with preparation and work afterwards and defusing afterwards. But the level of intensity of the emotions, in terms of the research, they would say it is one of the most emotional jobs. And I remember somebody saying that you can experience as many as 10 emotions in the first half hour in a classroom in the morning. If you're going in to work, as some people are in offices, in those kind of boots, you know, you can experience, but you're not going to have the range of emotions that you have when you're dealing with, you know, 25 children or 30 children or whatever. So number one, it's a very emotional job. So you're experiencing all of these emotions. And the first element of it is that you need to be able to manage those emotions. You need not to be able to let those emotions control you. You need to be able to control them. You need to be able to recognize the positive ones, and you need to be able to upregulate them or enhance them or prolong them. And you need, with the negative ones, to be able to lessen them and let them go. And that doesn't mean that you let them go, perhaps without, you have to do something about it. If you're very angry with someone, it's very important that you're able to actually articulate that how you feel, so that you can diffuse your emotion. And even with the child, to challenge their behaviour appropriately. Because if you don't challenge it appropriately, the anger is going to escalate and the upset is going to escalate. So it is really about managing the emotions. The second element of it, I suppose, would be managing the emotions of the students. And to a larger sense, that's something similar to what we've talked about. So if there are negative emotions, to helping them to diffuse them by how you treat them. And if there are positive emotions in the classroom, you maximise the opportunities to give children a sense of pride and achievement and recognition. And that's what creates the emotional climate in the classroom. And the emotional climate is pivotal and central to learning in the classroom. So managing the emotion of children and diffusing their negative emotions. The other element of the emotions in the school would be having an emotional dimension to the lessons that you're actually teaching. So they talk a bit about the emotional connection in terms of maybe the emotional scaffolding. We know quite a bit about scaffolding in education, where, you know, they achieve something that they're able to achieve and then they can build on that to achieve something more. But it's getting them to connect emotionally with what you're doing and then to build on the emotional dimensions of it. So it's something similar, but it's about the emotions. Say, for example, if you take even a history lesson or something like that, and you're talking about maybe Second World War, and you're talking about the plight of the Jews or something like that, and you bring it to the modern day kind of scenarios where they're more familiar with it from the news, things you can bring from Syria, the whole immigration question, bringing it down to the human dimension so that they can relate emotionally to it. Then they become interested. And then you can teach facts and figures and all of those things. But if you don't get them, emotionally connected
and engaged.
Engaged, exactly. The emotional labour is another element of the emotional side of it. And that's really where, for leaders, have to learn to be able to express their emotions appropriately. And the research would say that a lot of leaders hide their emotions and they fake them, which is even worse. They paint on this smile when they're really angry or really upset. So they're faking on a grand scale. I've seen whole schools faking, actually. You know, they're not faking. If you go into a school where there is, aggressive behaviour going on, they're usually straight out aggressive with each other. And that's a very bad environment to be in. But the second worst one is where everyone is pretending that everything is fine. And everyone has the painted on smile and saying, good morning and how are you and whatever. But you always have to look at the knuckles. And the knuckles tell it, the white knuckles. And particularly leaders in education, where they feel that they will be very vulnerable if they express their emotions. They don't know how to do it appropriately, perhaps. So they fake them and they let on. Even when they're mad, even when everybody knows they're mad. Everyone knows, but it's leaky because emotions leak out. So, but they're faking. And faking on a grand scale in a job like teaching, where relationships and relating to each other and the emotions are central to it, is very damaging. Very damaging to the well-being of the person, very damaging to the relationships, because people see them as inauthentic or, you know, not genuine or whatever. And really, really damaging to the physical health as well. On a grand scale. In some professions, faking is obligatory, like in some of the service industries, like in the planes when they come in and, you know, they smile at you and they say you're welcome and you're in row 42 down there. And you can know by them that they say, and don't dare ring that bell between now and New York, you know. But they have to fake. And then if you do ring the bell, they have to go down and say, yes, madam, what would you like? Because that's part and parcel of it. Does take its toll on them and they do have to let off steam afterwards. But if teachers are doing it, no. because the relationships, the connections are far more important. They're central to it. We can't be letting on. But at the same time, it doesn't mean the critics of expressing your emotions would say, oh, well, you can't be going around emoting all over the place. And nobody's saying that. But it is very important if you're to build a relationship with someone that you're able to tell them when, you know, when you're feeling angry or when you're feeling upset or when you're feeling hurt to some extent. And when you're feeling in good form as well, to be able to show the bright side. Leaders who bring positive emotions into school, the benefits are enormous. So it's not that we expect people to be coming in happy, clappy, chirpy, hey, hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work, I go every day. But it's about being conscious of managing them to keep a balance. So to keep a balance of expressing your positive emotion, bringing them with you and expressing them, and also being able to express them when you're not feeling the best. And people think that if they do it, they're going to show themselves up as being weak. And it's not the case. Might be with some people, but they're always going to be critical anyway.
And just looking at that part of the title, and maybe you've touched on this, positive behaviours, relationships and emotions. Mm. Now, the subtitle mentions the heart of leadership in a school, but the first part doesn't actually mention a school setting. How important are these other elements outside of schools? Oh.
Totally transferable and totally relevant. The only thing is we couldn't take, for example, the book and take out just the word school, because my first love is education. I was a primary teacher for 19 years and most of my teaching I was at third level, and I'm mad interested in education. I think teachers are amazing. I might be sound as if I'm picking on some of the negative things here, but I have a huge admiration for teachers and for the education system in Ireland. Not that I don't think it can't be improved or whatever, but comparatively speaking, I think it's really good. I think parents have the right focus, by and large. Most of the theoretical aspects of the behaviours, relationships and emotions in a workplace, I've put them into the school setting. But if I were, and settings are slightly different, of course, in different work, because schools are very specific, actually. Schools are colleges. You could probably easily, it could be easily transferable to college, but not really to university, slightly different. But the theoretical background to everything that I've discussed in terms of positive behaviours, relationships and emotions, totally relevant to all other workplaces.
And another topic you discussed there is bullying.
Yes.
And how prevalent is bullying in among staffs in schools?
Well, I mean, I'm not able to. I mean, statistics are very scarce. There was a lot more emphasis on workplace bullying in schools in Ireland prior to the recession. Because during those times, people were looking at quality of work environment and schools, because there was plenty of money for everything. So the focus in terms of training and people's needs and people's thinking about quality of work life and balance, they had more money to be going off on holidays and doing things. But once the recession hit, the conditions of your workplace in terms of how you were treated faded into insignificance, because the line was, particularly in schools, to those working in the public sector generally, haven't you got a job? You don't expect people to be nice to you as well. So all of the behaviours went slightly underground. They got kind of swallowed up in the general morass of depression that was around that time, with all of the cuts that people had to take and salary and the conditions and resources and everything. So there aren't really contemporary figures on it, but I can say for certain anecdotally that a lot of the cases that went underground during that recessionary time have re-emerged. I can say it in terms of being contacted by people about them, but I can also say it in terms of court cases. I do so-called expert witness reports for the court cases, and there's been a significant increase in the number of those cases. Now, that's not really reflective of a huge increase at the moment. It is reflective of the ones that were dormant and have been reenacted perhaps now, but the research, and as I said, from a contemporary perspective, there isn't much quantitative research to back up what I'm going to say, but there is a level of consistency across the research on workplace bullying that the education sector is up there near the top of the workplaces where bullying would be prevalent.
And what kind of advice would you give to a teacher who thinks they're being bullied by colleagues?
Well,
by one or more colleagues?
I mean, it is really, really difficult because the approach of schools to workplace bullying has, in general, been buried the head in the sand. I have actually broken down the approaches into four different levels, let's say. And I started with the lowest one, which is the dismissive approach, which is, that bully, wouldn't be bothered about that. Sure, look, a bit of bullying never did anyone any harm. Toughen them up, and if they can't stand the heat in the kitchen. Now, to be honest, you wouldn't have that approach to any large extent in schools, but you would in some other workplaces. Then there's the minimum compliance approach, which is, and these are my own categories, the minimum compliance approaches would be, yes, this whole bullying now is raising its head. What are we going to do about it? So it's ticking the boxes. We better have a policy. Oh, maybe we'll get one from school up the road and do a bit of cut and paste. And sometimes they do it themselves even, but, you know, it's really the covering your back approach. And there would be a lot of schools in that. I think, I can only speak now from personal experience of people who contact me, and I'm asking questions, obviously. Then there's the reactive approach, and there would be schools in that that would be very conscious of having not just an anti-bullying policy for children, but for the staff, probably recognising, and of course this is the main thing that they do have to recognise, that if the staff are bullying each other, the message that's sent to the kids is it's okay to bully here. That's what we do. But the reactive would be one for where they'd have a lot of things in place for dealing with cases when they do arise. But they wouldn't be dealing specifically with preventing it. And where the focus has got to be is the fourth one, which is the proactive one, which is preventing workplace bullying. And that is about creating the type of climate we're talking about, openness, people, you know, discuss things where problems are aired, all of that. There's a whole combination of things, a recognising that the culture and climate in the organisation very much influences the quality of service, everything. So there's a whole lot in there, but you won't find too many there. And the initiative in that, I would say, has to come from the Department of Education. Because the Department of Education has to say, we have a responsibility to provide a psychologically safe environment for everybody in school. And how are we going to do it? We are not going to do it by a dismissive attitude, of course. We're not going to do it by just covering, ticking the boxes. We're not even going to do it by having, oh yes, we've mediation in place. Oh yes, we're calling an investigator. That's not it. We have to do it by working to provide that wider environment. So, in the context of where the individual school is, that determines how empowered the person can be to deal with it if they happen to be subjected to it. And it is very difficult. However, I have talked a bit about the personal resources and the social resources that one can draw on to perhaps impact on the dynamic of bullying. I am really slow to say this because it's putting the onus on the person who's been picked on to resolve it. And I'm not doing that. But I am saying to them, to get them to think in a different way about it. Bullying is a dynamic. It is like a dance. The bully leads, and unless the person who's picked on follows, there's no bullying. And so, of course, you follow because you're pulled into it. It's controlled. Very difficult to avoid it. But if you can understand that and do something even slightly different that gives off a different dynamic. One of the dynamics that keeps bullying going is the sense of the hurt of the person. I mean, this is very hard to say, that somebody would be empowered in their bullying by seeing somebody hurt, seeing somebody in pain. So, I mean, that's what keeps it going. I mean, I would have examples of people who would say the bullying got worse when my mother was sick, or the bullying got worse when my mother was dying. That's when it escalated up, because that's the most potential to hurt. But if the person can manage their level of hurt in terms of how they look at the person who's doing it. So I've quite a bit in there about personal resource. I'm very reluctant to do it with students, because a lot of schools would say, well, you know, they don't anymore. They're very much clued in now, but they're still finding it very difficult to resolve bullying. But I would say you have to guard against bringing the person who's, you know, allegedly bullying and the person who's been bullied together, because it's not a level playing pitch. So people will make mistakes like that. And the same with adults. Adults are terrified if they're bullied. But to get them to really use their social resources, their friends and families, often they don't tell anybody, particularly men. They don't tell anyone. They cry going home in the car. I would have men, and the minute they're talking to me, they're only 5 minutes talking, and they're absolutely in floods of tears. They don't cry in front of their spouses. They don't even maybe share it. Even. And sometimes they find, even talking, say, somebody like me that understands it, that even that helps them, because now they think, I'm not imagining it, I'm not a weakling, I'm not paranoid. Because people accuse them of being paranoid. And even that can change the dynamic. So I do provide some advice about the various resources they can draw on. But ideally, it should be that a school is psychologically safe for both its staff and its students. And that initiative comes from a good leader. You can have the amazing principals out there and deputy principals, and they've created that kind of school where it's not tolerated. It's not tolerated. And actually, it's the message of, we don't tolerate it here. That's a very important message, because if you don't have that message sent and then you start dealing with it with children, the parents are up in arms. But if you've set the tone of, here's what we do, you know, if there's bullying going on or if anybody is worried about bullying, here's what we do. So if you don't want to send your child to this school, fine, go off somewhere else. And there are some amazing schools out there. And they just have that respect, that openness, that collegiality, that democracy. And honestly, bullying lessons. So it's a very complex subject, but understanding it is very important. And people to understand that you're not totally disempowered. Even if the organisation's letting you down, you have resources within yourself to change the dynamic.
A hopeful note for anyone who experiences bullying in a school setting from Jacinta Kitt, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. I was speaking to Jacinta Kitt to mark the publication of her new book, Positive Behaviours, Relationships and Emotions, The Heart of Leadership in a School. You can listen to hundreds of podcasts of previous programmes on seandelaney.com/podcasts. My new book, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available now online and in good bookshops locally. Until the same time next week, that's all from me, Sean Delaney. Have a great week.